Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and good evening, my dear brothers and sisters. I am impressed that the hall is still relatively full at this late hour of the day. I hope we can get through the next hour and that I hold your attention. I rather feel perhaps that I might, not because of the excellence or genius of what I'm about to present, but because you may or may not be aware that the subject of our topic tonight is concerning two reunion endeavours within the biblical record. And of course, the moment I use perhaps that key and strategic word, then some of the relevance of what tonight might be about immediately springs to mind. And as our brother Reuben attached various wires and cords to my person, I'm made aware so acutely, as in all of these circumstances, that everything you say may be taken down and used in evidence against you. And so naturally, I'm going to choose my words with care tonight. And so I just want to make a couple of caveat comments, really, before I begin, and that's this. Firstly, you should know that the substance of what I'm about to say tonight was prepared a number of years ago in New Zealand without any reference to matters over here. And so I don't want you to think that this has been prepared to launch a little bomb attack or to try and in any way influence outcomes of what might be going on in the North American continent at this stage. And I can assure you that that material was prepared, at least as far as my Bible study was concerned, a number of years earlier. Having said that, however, you may or may not find that some of the things I'm about to say could be relevant or pertinent to current processes. That will be for you to decide whether any of these principles apply, to what extent they should apply, and in what measure or capacity they might be useful for the future. So can I just make that as an introductory comment before we start? But I'm going to hew very carefully and closely to the line of the actual Bible story that I'm going to follow tonight, the folly of Jehoshaphat and the wisdom of Hezekiah. Strange thing, actually, because, you see, I think that these two men are tied together in the record in this respect, that I believe they both shared the same Bible hero. I think they both looked up to Solomon, you see. I think there are signs in the record of Jehoshaphat's life and signs in the record of Hezekiah's life that Solomon was their hero and their mentor. They look back to the golden age of Israel's history and oh, how they desired that they might be able to recreate the greatness and the glory of that earlier time. But perhaps as we look at these two men, we will find that whereas the one strove to repeat the great exploits of Solomon of old, the other sought to emulate his spiritual achievements. And perhaps in that slight but subtle difference, we have the key to what's going to transpire and unfold in our story tonight. Well, we haven't got time to trace the analogies between Jehoshaphat and Solomon and Hezekiah and Solomon, but maybe just by way of illustration, if I just make this point, that Jehoshaphat, for example, received presents from those under him, says the 2nd of Chronicles 17, just like Solomon did in the 1st of Kings 4. We're told that Jehoshaphat busied himself to build store cities, just like Solomon had done in the second of Chronicles. We're told of Jehoshaphat that he sought to duplicate a shipping expedition with ships to Tarshish, just like Solomon had done in a previous time. And it would appear that Jehoshaphat was very conscious of how similar in some ways he was to Solomon, how desperately he would have liked to have restored the situation back to the Solomonic era. And in a sense, Hezekiah was the same. In his great Passover, which we'll come to a little later on in our session tonight, our late night session, the very detail of the fellowship offerings that are given, the very story of how 7 days were copied by another 7 days, so that in total they companied together for 14 days, is all borrowed from the story of Solomon's great feast. The 2nd of Chronicles chapter 30 becomes a mirror image of the 1st of Kings chapter 8. And the very power of the Feast of the One to unite the nation is seen as in some ways being replicated from an earlier time. So I think these two men are strangely bound together, Jehoshaphat and Hezekiah, inasmuch as they both admired Solomon. So let me start then with the story of Jehoshaphat tonight. I'd like you to come with me to the 2nd of Chronicles and chapter 18. The second of Chronicles, chapter 18. What we're going to do is I'm just going to briefly, as it were, sketch the story from the Bible record, and then out of the life of each man, we're going to draw some critical lessons concerning matters of unity and fellowship. We're told in the second of Chronicles, chapter 18, in verse 1, the record says, "Now Jehoshaphat had riches and honour in abundance." And I think that's quite significant, because I think that in a sense that's like the first of Kings, chapter 10, verse 23, when it says, "So King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom." See, I think Jehoshaphat had got to such a stage of material prosperity that, well, in a sense, it was like the good old days of Solomon. And so the record says that he joined affinity with Ahab. And in fact, he joined affinity, by the way, by means of joining his son Jehoram in marriage to Ahab's daughter Athaliah, in the second of Kings chapter 8 and verse 18. And so the affinity of second Chronicles 18 verse 1 was a political alliance sealed by marriage, a political alliance engineered by Jehoshaphat and sealed by marriage. After all, isn't that what Solomon had done? First of Kings chapter 3 verse 1 says that Solomon made affinity with Egypt and sealed the political alliance by the marriage of himself to Solomon's to Pharaoh's daughter. Now, the interesting thing about this alliance, this political alliance between Judah and Israel in the second of Chronicles 18 verse 1, is it was initiated by Jehoshaphat. There's no evidence to suggest that Ahab asked for it or sought for it. It was the initiative of Jehoshaphat himself. And I think he did all of this for a reason, brothers and sisters. And I think that reason's back in the first of Kings chapter 4. If you come just briefly back to the first of Kings 4, we're told this, you see, going back to the time of Solomon, "I feel certain that this was part of the spirit that drove Jehoshaphat on this occasion." In the first of Kings chapter 4, we will be told, verse 1, "So King Solomon was king over all Israel." And again, verse 20, "Judah and Israel were many as the sand of the sea, as the sand which is by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and making merry." And again, verse 25, "And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, from Dan even to Beersheba, all the days of Solomon." And I think that that's what Jehoshaphat wanted to do, you see. I think he sought affinity that he might bring back the northern kingdom into spiritual unity with the south, that he might recreate the time of Solomon when Judah and Israel were bound together from Dan to Beersheba. That's what he wanted to do. So he tried to achieve that by means of this political alliance in the second of Kings chapter 18. Well, if you come back to the first of Kings chapter 22, we have the king's record of the details of how that alliance unfolded, because it was both uneasy and in fact ultimately tragic. Of course, Jehoshaphat persuaded himself that it was all in a good cause, at least to start with, because it says in the first of Kings 22 and in verse 3, "The king of Israel said unto his servants, 'Know ye that Ramoth and Gilead is ours, and we be still, and take it not out of the hand of the king of Syria.' And he said unto Jehoshaphat, 'Wilt thou go with me to battle to Ramoth Gilead?'" Now, of course, there was a very good reason for Jehoshaphat to say, "Oh, yes, I will," because, well, after all, Ramoth Gilead was one of the cities of refuge. It was a biblical institution, and Israel had lost that city. And so the plea that we might recover a city of refuge, why, that's a very good cause to be associated with. And so Jehoshaphat said this, quite interesting in verse 4, he said to the king of Israel, "I am as thou art, my people as thy people, my horses as thy horses." Of course, we're told, aren't we, in the book of Deuteronomy, that kings weren't supposed to multiply horses, but Jehoshaphat had. But then, of course, so had Solomon, his hero, you see. Perhaps that's why he had multiplied horses. But you see this pledge of alliance: "I am as thou art, my people as thy people." And so Ahab persuaded Jehoshaphat to join him in battle to recover one of the cities of refuge, and he pledges his complete support. And yet, for all of that, things were a little uneasy, weren't they? Verse 6. Jehoshaphat said, verse 5, let's inquire at the word of Yahweh today. And the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men. What a suspicious sounding number, brothers and sisters. Because 400 men doesn't sound to me like the prophets of Yahweh. As well you might know, these are the prophets of Jezebel's grove in the 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 19. And for that very reason, we're told in verse 7 that Jehoshaphat said rather uneasily, isn't it there not here a prophet of Yahweh besides that we might inquire of him? So here's a man who has said, I am as thou art, my people as thou art, as thy people. And yet for all of that, there was no real unity of spirit here at all. Why, they worship different gods. Their prophets spoke absolutely different messages. And yet for all of that, look at the picture of verse 10. The king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, sat each on his throne, having put on their robes in a void place in the entrance of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets prophesied before them. Here was this marvelous sign, this marvelous show of unity. These two kings on their royal thrones in their royal robes, seated majestically side by side. But the prophets that subsequently came and paraded before these two men didn't speak the words of truth. They'd corrupted the doctrine of God. And Jehoshaphat should never have been there. And Micaiah, the only one and true prophet, of course, who came and gave his message and said there would be disaster that day. The record says, verse 28, Micaiah said, if thou return at all in peace, Yahweh hath not spoken by me. And yet despite the warning of that prophet, brothers and sisters, Jehoshaphat went to battle with the king of Israel because of this alliance that he'd made. And verse 30 says, isn't it remarkable really? Verse 30, the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, look, I'll tell you what we'll do. He said, I'll disguise myself so that I just look like any ordinary person, but why don't you put on your royal robes before you go into battle? In fact, the Septuagint version says, put thou on my robes. So the suggestion was that Jehoshaphat should go to battle clad in the robes of the king of Israel, while the king of Israel went incognito into the battle. Here's true unity, brothers and sisters. The one king caring for the needs of the other, you see. And so the king of Israel disguised himself and went into battle. And of course, the king of Syria, verse 31, we're told, had mentioned to his captains to seek only the king that he might fight against them. And the record says, verse 32, it came to pass, when the captains of the chariot saw Jehoshaphat, they said, surely it is the king of Israel. And they turned aside to fight against him. And Jehoshaphat cried out, and it came to pass, when the captains of the chariots perceived that it was not the king of Israel, they turned back from pursuing him. And Jehoshaphat, brothers and sisters, came within a hair's breadth of his life that night. And when the record says that the captains of the chariots turned away, it wasn't by any accident, it was by the hand of providence. Because if you come back to the 2nd of Chronicles and chapter 18, we're told this specifically in the Chronicles record. 2nd of Chronicles chapter 18 and verse 31 tells us, it was only by the divine intervention of God himself that Jehoshaphat was saved on this occasion. And so the record says in verse 31, 2 Chronicles 18, it came to pass when the captains of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat that they said, it is the king of Israel. Therefore they compassed about him to fight, but Jehoshaphat cried out, and Yahweh helped him, and God moved them to depart from him. And if God had not intervened, surely the king of Judah would have been dead that night. And when chapter 19, verse 1 says that Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned to his house in peace to Jerusalem, it was only by the providence of God that he did so, brothers and sisters, because the king of Israel lay dead on the battlefield. Ahab lost his life on that same day, did he not, in battle? And verse 2 of 2 Chronicles 19 says that a man went forth to greet Jehoshaphat on his return. And this is what he said about the alliance that he'd entered into. Jehu, the son of Hanani, the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate Yahweh? Therefore is wrath upon thee from before Yahweh. Nevertheless, there are good things found in thee, in that thou hast taken away the groves out of the land, and hast prepared thy heart to seek God. And Jehoshaphat dwelt at Jerusalem. And he went out again from the people, from Beersheba to Mount Ephraim, and brought them back unto Yahweh Elohim of their fathers. And at least for a brief period of time, brothers and sisters, we're told that Jehoshaphat was inspired by the rebuke of the prophet to cease active association with Israel and to turn back to reinvigorating Judah instead, as he did, as the record says. But notice the key words, verse 4, which must have gnawed away at the soul of Jehoshaphat. He went out again through the people from Beersheba to Mount Ephraim. But what did he really want, brothers and sisters? He wanted Beersheba to Dan. He wanted the time of Solomon. This was still only half the story, brothers and sisters. And so 1 year later, we're told this in the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 20, in verse 35. Just 1 year later, after the rebuke of the prophet of God, it says this, 2nd Chronicles, chapter 20, verse 35, "And after this did Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, join himself with Ahaziah, king of Israel, who did very wickedly, and he joined himself with him to make ships to go to Tarshish." Here's another alliance. Now, this time it's not a political alliance. This time it's a commercial alliance. He entered into commercial alliance in order to establish a shipping business. And why those very ships, verse 36, were going to go to Tarshish, just like Solomon's had in an earlier time. And not only that, but they were going to be docked, verse 36, at Ezion-Geber, why the very place where Solomon had held his ships on an earlier occasion. But this was not a good idea, brothers and sisters. Verse 37 says, "Then Eliezer, the son of Dodavar of Marishah, prophesied against Jehoshaphat, saying, Because thou hast joined thyself with Ahaziah, Yahweh hath broken thy works, and the ships were broken, that they were not able to go to Tarshish." So Jehoshaphat's second endeavor at alliance was thwarted by God himself, and he was on a second occasion rebuked by a prophet of God for allying himself with a man that did wickedly. And did you notice the key phrase, verse 35? He did join himself. Verse 36, he joined himself. Verse 37, thou hast joined thyself. You see, this was something that was initiated solely and absolutely and unilaterally by Jehoshaphat. He pledged his whole country, his whole nation, all driven by his own circumstances, and the ships were broken. And you would think that he learned the lesson for a moment. In fact, probably he did, because later on we're told, which we won't go back to, but in the first of Chronicles 22, the king of Israel said, "Look, let's try again, shall we? How about this time I send my servants, which I think are better shippers than you, and let's do this thing together again." And Jehoshaphat said, no, I won't. I won't enter into this again. And yet, you'd never guess what happened 1 year later, brothers and sisters. If you come to the first of Kings, the second of Kings, rather, and chapter 3, just 1 year later again, the record says this. In the 2nd of Kings chapter 3 and verse 1, it says, "Now Jehoram, the son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel and Samaria. The 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and reigned 12 years. He did evil." And the record says, verse 6, "And King Jehoram went out of Samaria the same time and numbered all Israel, and he went and sent to Jehoshaphat the king of Judah, saying, The king of Moab hath rebelled against me. Wilt thou go with me against Moab to battle? And Jehoshaphat said, All brothers and sisters, where have you heard these words before? I will go up. I am as thou art, my people as thy people, and my horses as thy horses." And this time we have a third alliance, a military alliance, for purposes of the battle against the king of Moab on this occasion. And yet it doesn't look good or feel good, because we're told in verse 10 of 2 Kings 3, the king of Israel said, "Alas, that Yahweh hath called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab." And Jehoshaphat said, "Is there not here a prophet of Yahweh that we may inquire of Yahweh by him?" And one of the king of Israel's servants said, well, Elisha is here, the son of Shaphat, which poured water on the hands of Elijah. And Jehoshaphat said, the word of Yahweh is with him. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Edom, went down to him. And Elisha said unto the king of Israel, and notice this, not to the king of Judah, but to the king of Israel, what have I to do with thee? Get thee to the prophets of thy father and to the prophets of thy mother. And the king of Israel said, nay, for Yahweh hath called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab. And Elisha said, as Yahweh of armies liveth, before whom I stand, surely were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would not look toward thee nor see thee. Do you think Jehoshaphat should have been here, brothers and sisters? Here's a third prophet of God that rebukes, in effect, Jehoshaphat for this unnecessary and unwise alliance. And when Elisha says in verse 14, as Yahweh of hosts liveth before whom I stand, where do those words come from? Why, that's the very cry of Elijah himself as he strode into the palace of Ahab. And it's a sign, I think, from Elisha that the same apostasy that existed in the days of Ahab was alive and strong here in the time of Jehoram. And yet Jehoshaphat is in full alliance with all of this. My people is thy people, I am as thou art. My horses as thy horses. There's something not good about all of this, is there, brothers and sisters? It somehow doesn't sound wise. So let's just review what happened as far as Jehoshaphat was concerned here. Jehoshaphat's folly. It's an unfortunate thing because, you know, in so many respects, Jehoshaphat was one of the best kings that Judah ever had. He's commended in a number of areas for the goodness of his reign. And yet what we've got is this, that his endeavors for union were undertaken unilaterally, driven by his own vision and objectives, but without the consent or the approval of the brethren in his fellowship community. The record makes it clear that these were all driven by Jehoshaphat himself. And the mere fact that prophets of God repeatedly rebuked him was clearly an indication that his own nation, his own people, did not stand with him, were not united with him, but he drove forward and onwards anyway, obsessed by his own mission. This was not a good basis for proceeding to try and reunite the northern and the southern kingdoms. He didn't see the need or the value to consult with his brethren before initiating such actions. And here's the second thing that wasn't good about it, brothers and sisters, is his willingness for alliance repeatedly overlooked major doctrinal and practical differences which should have been resolved before mutual participation, and yet they were not. And Jehoshaphat sits down and listens to the nonsense of the prophets of the grove, having already said, I am as thou art, my people as thy people. He's already pledged total participation and involvement, and yet clearly none of the doctrinal differences between the northern and southern kingdoms have been really resolved at all. But he's already in participation. Oh yes, I'll come. I'll come straight away, he says. That wasn't wise. That wasn't a biblically sound approach. And there were consequences that would flow from that. And here's the third thing. His eagerness for affinity showed more commitment to the idea of demonstrating friendship, sitting on two royal thrones, going out to fight king's battles, and to engaging in activities together than to resolving the real matters of division. Jehoshaphat knew that he was in the company of people that did not share the same spirit of the truth. He knew that, brothers and sisters. You can tell from the uneasiness of his words. Is there not here perhaps a prophet of God? And the very tentative way in which he asks that question shows that he had absolutely no confidence that there might be such an one in this kingdom that he's just pledged alliance to. You know, brothers and sisters, I believe that Jehoshaphat's motive was good. I think his motive was sincere. He desperately wanted to bring these two kingdoms back if he possibly could. In 3 years, on three separate occasions, he seeks alliance between the northern and southern kingdoms. But the foundation wasn't good. And not only the foundation, brothers and sisters, but more sadly and more tragically, the consequences would be dramatic as well, and they would not be good. And here's the first one. Because you see, the consequences of what we do are always things that follow inevitably as harvest follows sowing. His thrice repeated attempt to ally never did bring spiritual reconciliation, but instead, through both son and grandson, introduced wrong doctrine into his own fellowship community. Come and have a look at the second of Chronicles and chapter 21. This is the miserable, the daunting, the terrifying story of his son and his grandson. Let's have a look at this because it's such a sad story, brothers and sisters. 2 Chronicles chapter 21, verse 1. Now, Jehoshaphat slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, and Jehoram, his son, reigned in his stead. And he had brethren, the sons of Jehoshaphat, Azariah and Jehiel and Zechariah and Azariah and Michael and Shephatiah. All these were the sons of Jehoshaphat, king of Israel. And their father gave them great gifts of silver and of gold and of precious things with fenced cities in Judah. But the kingdom gave he to Jehoram, because he was the firstborn. Now, when Jehoram was risen up to the kingdom of his father, he strengthened himself. He slew all his brethren with the sword, and divers also of the princes of Israel. Jehoram was 32 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 8 years in Jerusalem, and he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. Not the kings of Judah, the kings of Israel, for he walked like as did the house of Ahab, for he had the daughter of Ahab to wife, and he wrought that which was evil in the eyes of Yahweh. This is the son of Jehoshaphat. And you see, that alliance whereby Jehoshaphat married off his son to a daughter of Jezebel introduced the doctrine of Ahab and the teaching of Ahab into the very house of Judah, and not just the son, but also the grandson. Because we're told in verse 1 of chapter 22, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem made Ahaziah, Jehoram's youngest son, king in his stead, for the bands of men that came with the Arabians to the camp had slain all the eldest. So Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, reigned. 42 years was Ahaziah when he began to reign. He reigned 1 year in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Athaliah, the daughter of Omri. He also walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, for his mother was his counselor to do wickedly. Wherefore he did evil in the sight of Yahweh, like the house of Ahab, for they were his counselors after the death of his father to his destruction. Who introduced all of that catastrophe into the house of Judah, brothers and sisters? But Jehoshaphat, desperately seeking alliance with Israel. And lastly, the effect of his efforts towards union are recorded as a blot on his otherwise good reign, since they destroyed his family and damaged his fellowship community. And in the first of Chronicles, chapter 22, and verses 43 and 44, is the final summation of the reign of this man. Let's just have a look at that, shall we? First of Kings, chapter 22, it says this. It's such a sad thing, really, because he was a good king. He was essentially a good king. And yet it says this, verse 43 of the first of Kings, 22. And he walked in all the ways of Asa his father. He turned not aside from it, doing that which was right in the eyes of Yahweh, did Jehoshaphat. Nevertheless, the high places were not taken away, for the people offered and burnt incense yet in the high places. And Jehoshaphat made peace with the king of Israel. And I'm not at all sure, brothers and sisters, that verse 44 of the first of Kings 22 is a mark in favor of Jehoshaphat. I think it's a blot on his reign, that this was one of the saddest mistakes of an otherwise good reign, that he was so driven to unite these two that in this one thing we could truly say, here was the folly of Jehoshaphat. And now come by way of contrast to the story of good King Hezekiah of Judah, who's going to turn up, of course, a little later in the story. In the second of Chronicles, and in the 29th chapter, we're going to be introduced to the time when Hezekiah comes upon the scene. And it was a dramatic coming, was it not, brothers and sisters? A very dramatic coming. Because the second of Chronicles, chapter 29 and verse 1 said, Hezekiah began to reign when he was 25 years old, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abiah, the daughter of Zechariah. He did that which was right in the sight of Yahweh, according to all that David his father had done. Now, I don't know whether Brother Peter said this here. I suspect that I've heard a comment back that maybe he did in one of his earlier studies, but did Brother Peter say something about getting on with things in one of his studies? About getting on with the work of the truth. Well, that was the spirit of Hezekiah, wasn't it? Verse 3, he, in the first year of his reign, in the first month, opened the doors of the house of Yahweh and repaired them. Except it wasn't just the first year, and it wasn't just the first month, because verse 17 says it was the first day. The first day of the first month of the first year of Hezekiah's life, he arrived like a rocket into the household of Judah, and he said, we are going to get this nation back on track spiritually. And he wasted no time. He brought in the priests and the Levites, verse 4, and he gathered them together. And before you knew it, you had all these musical singers with tender fingers that plucked instruments, suddenly lugging out the rubble of apostasy from the temple and taking it down to the Brook Kidron. He got the nation cracking, brothers and sisters. He really got them moving. And yet the sad thing was, verse 17, they began on the first day of the first month to sanctify. On the eighth day of the month, they came to the porch of Yahweh. So they sanctified the house of Yahweh in 8 days. And in the 16th day, they made an end. And he missed Passover, brothers and sisters, by just 2 days. 48 hours, he missed Passover. See, that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to have the place clean for Passover. He missed it by just 2 days. But it didn't deter him. Look, verse 20, Hezekiah the king rose early, gathered up the rulers of the city, went up to the house of Yahweh, and they held a celebration with the offering of solemn sacrifices. He set, verse 25, the Levites in the house of Yahweh with the cymbals and the psalteries and the harps according to the commandment of David. Everything was done according to the old standard. The old standards were restored of music and praise and worship. And the record says, verse 28, that all the congregation worshipped, and the singers sang, and the trumpeters sounded, and all this continued until the burnt offering was finished. And when they'd made an end of offering, the king and all that were present with him bowed themselves in worship. You know, one of the remarkable things about Hezekiah, brothers and sisters, was his capacity to inspire other people. He didn't just go marching into this by himself, did he, like Jehoshaphat? He brought everyone along with him. The whole nation celebrated with him on this occasion. See the last verse of 2 Chronicles, chapter 29. And Hezekiah rejoiced, and all the people, that God had prepared the people, for the thing was done. Whew! Suddenly, this new whirlwind king that arrived. But you see, he brought the people with him. That was the marvelous thing. And now the record says that the ambitions of Hezekiah were perhaps, in a sense, no smaller than Jehoshaphat. Because chapter 30, 2 Chronicles chapter 30, verse 1 says, and Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah, and wrote letters also to Ephraim and Manasseh that they should come to the house of Yahweh at Jerusalem to keep the Passover unto Yahweh Elohim of Israel. There was going to be a Passover celebration. And the very basis on which he'd done that was that they decided that they could keep, at the end of verse 2, they could keep the Passover in the second month. Because they found in the book of the law, and the margin says quite correctly, Numbers chapter 9, that a specific provision was made by Moses that if a person was rendered unclean and incapable of keeping the Passover on the appointed day of the first month, that they were entitled to keep the Passover on the second month. And Hezekiah said, well, that's us. The whole nation's unclean. We're all unprepared. And so on the basis of the spirit of Numbers chapter 9, they took up that possibility to say, well, let's have a Passover celebration anyway. And so this is what they did, verse 5. they established a decree to make proclamations throughout all Israel from, why? From Beersheba even to Dan. That's interesting, isn't it? All Israel were invited to this Passover celebration, and that they should come to keep the Passover unto Yahweh Elohim of Israel at Jerusalem, for they'd not done it of a long time in such sort as it was written. So he wrote letters. He wrote letters of invitation to join in fellowship, in unity. Come, come, he says, come to the Passover. Let's try and get the two kingdoms back together again on a sound basis. Well, let me just show you a couple of things by way of conclusion to this story, and then we'll come back to the lessons of Hezekiah. We're told in verse 21 that the children of Israel that were present at Jerusalem kept the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with great gladness. And the Levites and the priests praised Yahweh day by day, singing with loud instruments unto Yahweh. Hezekiah spake comfortably unto all the Levites that taught the good knowledge of Yahweh, and they did eat throughout the feast 7 days, making peace offerings and making confession to Yahweh Elohim of their fathers. And the whole assembly, verse 23, took counsel to keep other 7 days, and they kept other 7 days with gladness. Now, hold your hands in the second of Chronicles and just come back for a moment to the first of Kings chapter 8, because the first of Kings chapter 8 at the end of the chapter is the story of the tremendous celebration feast that was held by Solomon on the occasion of the dedication of the temple. And this is what it says, verse 64 of 1 of Kings 8. The same day did the king hallow the middle of the court that was before the house of Yahweh, for there he offered burnt offerings and meat offerings and the fat of the peace offerings, because the brazen altar that was before Yahweh was too little to receive the burnt offerings and the meat offerings and the fat of the peace offerings. And if you go back to the time of Hezekiah, you'll find that the number of offerings they offered was so large and so extensive that they got behind on the schedule of the offerings. He offered in that same generous spirit as did Solomon. And then you see what it says in 1 Kings 8, verse 65. And at that time, Solomon held a feast, and all Israel with him, a great congregation, from the entering in of Hamath unto the river of Egypt, before Yahweh our God, why, 7 days and another 7 days. Even 14 days. And on the 8th day, he sent the people away, and they blessed the king and went into their tents, joyful and glad of heart for all the goodness that Yahweh had done. See what it says in the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 30, verse 23. The whole assembly took counsel to keep other 7 days, and they kept other 7 days with gladness. Where do you think that idea came from, brothers and sisters? It comes straight out of the celebration of the great feast of Solomon in the 1st of Kings, chapter 8. And we know that the spirit of Solomon, was achieved on this occasion, because do you see what the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 30, verse 26 says? Right at the end of the chapter. So there was great joy in Jerusalem, for since the time of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, there was not the like in Jerusalem. Never before had there been such a celebration. Never before had there been such a gathering of people committed together for the worship of God in spirit and in truth. And the lovely thought at the end of the verse, verse 27, then the priests, the Levites, arose and blessed the people, and their voice was heard, and their prayer came up to his holy dwelling place. Oh, do you know where that comes from, brothers and sisters? That's straight out of the prayer of Solomon at the dedication of the temple, that when this people lift up their voice, might our prayer, might our supplication ascend into heaven thy dwelling place, cried Solomon over and over again in his prayer. And the record says, at the end of this great celebration in the days of Hezekiah, that the prayer really did come up into the dwelling place of God, just as it was according to the prayer of Solomon in ancient times. Marvelous, brothers and sisters. Now let's have a look and see what the difference is in terms of the spirit of Hezekiah on this occasion. He acted with a lot more prudence. And here's the first key thing, I think, to Hezekiah's wisdom. I want you to notice this carefully in the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 30. His initiative for unity only came after careful and widespread counsel, so that his entire fellowship community were wholeheartedly in support of the proposal. Do you see what it says? Read it with me, brothers and sisters. I'm going to take it off the screen so you cannot be distracted. Isn't that kind of me? I shall put it up, but look, verse 2. Read it carefully. For the king, says the Revised Standard Version, and his princes, and all the assembly in Jerusalem had taken counsel. You see, the whole thing with Jehoshaphat is he did it on his own, did it on his own, did it on his own, pledged the nation on his own. Hezekiah didn't do that. Hezekiah took counsel with all his elders and with all the congregation in Jerusalem before they made this decision to make an offer to the southern, to the northern kingdom, before they entered into any form of unity discussions, as it were. Verse 4, and the thing pleased the king and all the congregation. So that whole community were together in the matter of this proposal going forward. Verse 12, also in Judah, the hand of God was to give them one heart to do the commandment of the king and of the princes by the word of Yahweh. And clearly what Hezekiah had done, that Jehoshaphat unfortunately never stopped to do, was to take time to not only take counsel with all his community, but to make sure that they discussed it from the word, from the word, from the word. And when there was a sound basis for that whole congregation to say, yes, we are with this proposal, the letters went forth, brothers and sisters, from the king, but with the common consent of that whole community that he represented or purported to represent. Here's the second thing. His call to fellowship was firmly based on upholding the Mosaic statement of faith concerning Passover without permitting the compromise of either its spirit or its substance. You see what it says in 2 Chronicles chapter 30, verse 5? It says that they established a decree to make proclamation that they should come to keep the Passover, but there was a condition. You've got to come to keep it to Yahweh Elohim of Israel at Jerusalem, and to do it in exactly the way that it's written in the law of Moses. It must be done in accordance with the law of Moses. Now, of course, you know the spirit of the northern kingdom, 1 Kings chapter 12. Wasn't it Jeroboam that said, look, he said, if the people go down to Jerusalem, they'll go back to Judah. So I'll build temples and priests and gods to worship in Bethel and Dan, and say there's no need to go down to Jerusalem. How about coming up here? Now you see, if you were to have had perhaps a Jehoshaphat initiative on this occasion, what would have happened is that Hezekiah would have said to the northern kingdom, well, look, how about we sort of meet in the middle? We won't come to Dan, and you don't have to come to Jerusalem, but how about as a show of good faith on both sides, how about we meet in Bethel and hold the Passover there in terms of this fellowship initiative? Hezekiah said, no. There's only one place you can keep the Passover. We want you to come. We desire to be in fellowship, but you've got to come to Jerusalem. It's the only place. You've got to come there. I'm sorry, there's no compromise on that. And we're going to do it after the way that it's written. There is no other way. And so he says in verse 8, don't be stiff-necked as your fathers were, but yield yourselves unto Yahweh and enter his sanctuary, which he has sanctified forever. This is the only place where we can worship God in this way. There can be no adjustment to that statement of faith by which we keep the Passover. So you see, Hezekiah was firm in what he proposed, even though he reached out to all of the tribes, he invited them all. It was a very careful basis, you see. And here's the last thing. His appeal for oneness required that those in Israel who responded should be prepared to yield. See verse 8? Yield yourselves. Be ready to yield, says Hezekiah, and be ready to return. Verse 6. Turn again, verse 9, turn again, at the end of verse 9, turn again. He asked them to return, to show the spirit of return to something original that they'd left behind in a previous time when these two kingdoms had so unfortunately divided, and they must show a spirit of genuine humility, he says. Look, verse 11, Nevertheless, divers of Asher and Manasseh and those of Zebulun humbled themselves and came to Jerusalem. If this thing was going to work, brothers and sisters, not only did the basis need to be sound and strong, but there would be humility involved in reconciling brethren to an earlier common standard. And Hezekiah was just so much more careful than Jehoshaphat, was he not, brothers and sisters? And the way he went about this thing. Now, do you want to know the consequences? The consequences that flowed from Hezekiah's approach as opposed to Jehoshaphat's. Well, do you notice what it says in verse 10? So the posts passed from city to city through the country of Ephraim and Manasseh, even unto Zebulun, and most of them laughed them to scorn and mocked them and said, we're not the slightest bit interested in reunion with you. And you know, brothers and sisters, I think the reality was Hezekiah didn't want them. I know that sounds like a strange thing to say, but he didn't want them. He didn't want people to come that weren't genuine. He didn't want people to come that weren't committed. He didn't want reunion with those that didn't believe in reunion or didn't see the need. You know, the really sad thing, brothers and sisters, those very brothers and sisters that laughed this initiative to scorn in verse 10 were gone within 6 years by the hand of the Assyrian, gone for good. Those very tribes that spurned this offer were taken out of the land within about 6 years. But here's the consequence. I think the first consequence is this, that his appeal only attracted those whose commitment was so genuine that Yahweh graciously overlooked their breach of preparation and gave divine sanction to the gathering. And we're told that because you see what it says, verse 18. A multitude of people that did come, the ones that had humbled themselves from verse 12, many of Ephraim and Manasseh and Issachar and Zebulun, those that did hear the appeal of the king, had not cleansed themselves, yet they did eat the Passover, otherwise than that it was written, but Hezekiah prayed for them, saying, the good Lord, Yahweh the good, pardon every one that prepareth his heart to seek God, to seek Yahweh Elohim of his fathers, though he be not cleansed according to the purification of the sanctuary. And because the people that were there were committed, were genuine, were sincere to refellowship in fullness of heart, we're told that God hearkened to the prayer of Hezekiah and graciously healed the people on this occasion. I think, by the way, that when it says that he healed them, it's not necessarily from plague, but that they were forgiven and pardoned for this breach, as Hezekiah himself had prayed for in the 18th verse. And not only did God pardon them, but we know at the end of the chapter, as we've already seen, that the things that did that day, the things done that day, brothers and sisters, ascended into heaven. And God heard them on that day and heard the blessed cries of gladness, I believe with approval. He gave divine sanction to this endeavor. And what was the result? Verses 21 to 23, the result was an experience of fellowship so deep, so joyous, so strong, that the whole assembly decided as one to prolong their mutual association together. Did you notice, brothers and sisters, in verse 23, that the initiative to extend the meeting, the initiative to extend the Bible school, wasn't the initiative of Hezekiah. It was the whole assembly that took counsel together. You see, Hezekiah had a marvelous way of bringing people together so that they definitely moved together, thought together, committed together. The whole congregation decided this. It was a marvelous thing. See, this is real fellowship, isn't it? This is what it feels like, brothers and sisters. This is the experience when there is truly unity amongst those that have come together on a common basis. And the net result of that was The effect of the episode was to bring about dramatic personal change in those who'd attended. We're told in the next chapter, they went forth and they break up all their idols, destroyed all their past way of life. And verses 5 and 6 tells us that they committed absolutely to the perpetuation of this new system of worship that Hezekiah had instituted. In fact, in the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 31, and verse 6, it says, "And concerning the children of Israel and Judah that dwelt in the cities of Judah." I think when you read that verse carefully, I think the implication is that there were some brothers and sisters came out of the northern kingdom, out of the kingdom of Israel, and migrated south and joined the fellowship community of Hezekiah and the kingdom of Judah. And those that did come came, brothers and sisters, because they really wanted to be united together. The folly of Jehoshaphat and the wisdom of Hezekiah. They both had the same desire, the same spirit. But sometimes, brothers and sisters, in fact, probably every time, how we go about things will have an enormous effect on the outcome and the consequence, will it not? So let's just stop and think about this in terms of a summary of the story of these two men. There is a vital difference between union and unity, between alliance and fellowship, between affinity and oneness. Union is the careful pact of compromise for perceived common good. Unity is the joyful acceptance and mutual admiration of divine standards. They're not the same thing, brothers and sisters. Alliance is the tacit accommodation of differences for supposed joint benefit. Fellowship is the kinship of fervent mutual assent to divine principles. Affinity is the strategic joining of resources for apparent combined advantage. Oneness is the inseparable bond of mutual love for divine truth. How vital that we understand that there is an enormous gulf betwixt these two. I think you see that that gulf was the thing that Jehoshaphat never realized. And there's an inevitable consequence that follows from pursuing either course. Spiritual discernment is needed to recognize the difference, for we will be held accountable not just for our intentions, but ultimately for the results of our actions. As will Jehoshaphat and Hezekiah in God's good time. The thing is that, brothers and sisters, that union leads to corruption, but true unity purifies. Alliance leads to feebleness, but true fellowship invigorates. And affinity leads to mediocrity, but oneness inspires. He that hath an ear, let him hear.